Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Gjenklang.
Velkommen til historier som endret verden. Denne episoden vil være på engelsk, da vi har fått storfint besøk fra utlandet. Today we will be talking about the samurai, the legendary Japanese warrior. And with us today is the wonderful Professor Stephen Turnbull. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
If we were to go through everything you've done, it would be an episode in itself. But for the layman listening, they might know you from your contributions to movies like Ronin 47, countless documentaries. There's games like Shogun, Total War 1 and 2. And thank you for those, by the way. They were brilliant. And plenty of books. I talked with a friend of mine, and I mentioned you were coming on. I said, I got 5 books of him.
Oh, only 5?
Only 5, yeah.
Oh, he must buy some more.
Yeah, he should. And as I said, documentaries, the most recently one, the Netflix documentary, Age of the Samurai.
Age of Samurai, that's yeah. Right, yes.
So, yeah, you're the go-to guy, to put it mildly. It's great to have you here. But this show is not the reason you're in Oslo. Why are you here now?
Well, I'm here because, as you probably know, in the historical museum at now they have the most marvelous exhibition of samurai armor and swords. It's one of the best displays I've ever seen. The collection is very fine, but I went there this morning and I was particularly impressed by how close you can get to the exhibits and almost touch them.
Oh.
And see the real detail, the quality of the workmanship, and learn so much about the samurai as a warrior, but also someone who enjoyed poetry and the tea ceremony. It's a wonderful exhibition, and I'm so glad to have come.
And you'll be having 2 lectures as well?
That's right. Saturday the 25th of November, they have me to do 2 lectures. I am really having to work to earn my visit to Norway. And talking about various aspects of the samurai culture.
Brilliant. So listeners, if you're interested, you know where to go visit. But back to the story down there. In popular culture, we have these groups that stand out from history, correct or not, and often with a national theme, like the English longbowmen, the French knight, the Norse Viking berserkers, and of course the Japanese samurai. What does the word samurai mean?
Well, that's the strange thing, because the meaning of the word changed through history.
Oh.
The original meaning means a servant. And even at the time when there were wars going on in Japan, for many hundreds of years, no warrior would want to be called a samurai.
Ooh.
Because that meant he was the servant of somebody else. And it's only really with the times of peace from the 17th century onward, that you have this idea of the samurai as a warrior class. And that was essentially using an old word of the someone who serves a lord. And now they were all serving the great lord, the shogun. And so then on, but now we tend to use, say, as you say, like the Norse Viking. It is a generic term for the Japanese warrior. And I think that's good because it gives people the understanding, the label of the term. So it's a good development. But people have to realize that there was this change in meaning over the years.
And by the way, my Japanese is non-existent, so in this episode I'll probably butcher every word there, so apologies in advance.
Well, I also apologize that my Norwegian is non-existent, so it is wonderful that your listeners can enjoy me in English.
But where did the samurai originate from? If we could go back to early Japan, because as far as I read, the country was kind of divided between the Heian to the south and the Emishi to the north?
You're almost getting there, okay. I think. No, but what you're referring to is a time round about the 11th, 12th century when there were rebellions and also the Japanese state, the imperial state, was expanding from southern and central Japan to the north. And that is when the emperors really started hiring these warriors as professional fighters, hence the name samurai. They served the emperor. And that's when you get the beginning of what we could call samurai culture, the mounted archer, the swords. You're absolutely right. That is the beginning of samurai history.
And we've seen them visualized, as you said, also with a certain armor and a certain sword or swords. Could you tell me or tell us a bit about that?
Yes, the famous what we call a samurai sword is one of the classic weapons of the world. Essentially, it's a curved sword, one that's forged in a very specialized way, using overlapping layers of iron and beaten. In other words, the creation of a fine steel by means of experience and tradition before the metallurgy, the chemistry, was really understood. Hmm. And in fact, some of the finest swords in Japanese history were made at this early period, 12th and 13th century, and still as sharp and keen today.
Wow. But what would be the difference between, let's say, a katana or like samurai sword or a medieval English long sword?
Well, I'm not a great expert on medieval European weapons, but my understanding is there was a different concept in how the swords were used. Now, I may be wrong here. I mean, I know about how the Japanese swords were used, the curved blade for cutting and slashing, as compared to more of the thrusting, the large scale stabbing of the European sword, and the delivery of a blow. Theoretically, a Japanese sword would be able to cut more deeply than the European sword. And I can see all the European medievalists going on the telephone now and saying he's wrong, but I'm the Japanese specialist.
But and the armor, what was special about that, the samurai armor?
Well, the samurai armor belongs to what you might call the East Asian tradition of armor making, which evolved in a totally different way from how we saw it in Europe. I mean, Europe, you have the evolution from chainmail and what we call the brigandine, where you've got the metal plate sewn inside cloth, with the addition of plate armor. And over the years, the plate armor becomes more extensive. Now, Japanese armor derives from essentially an earlier Chinese model, where instead of chain or big plate, you have small plates laced together tightly to make a bigger plate.
Okay.
It's called lamellar armour because they're made of lamellae, a Latin term for small piece. And it is quite remarkable how it worked, because you would have a row of these small metal scales bound together and then lacquered so that the iron wouldn't rust, and then sewn together vertically in a series of plates. So you have a suit of armour that is very, very flexible and bends, and yet always presents a strong metal surface to someone who is attacking you. A totally clever, different concept. And again, theoretically, it should be able to withstand a sword blow like a plate armour would. But then, of course, the whole history of military warfare throughout in any culture is the contest between the defensive and the offensive. And so at the same time, you're always trying to develop a weapon that would cut through or break this armour. And in Japan, it's exactly the same.
An everlasting arms race.
Yes, literally, the personal arms race for the knight.
What made the samurai special? Were they chosen for something because they had a specific skill set? Were they born into it?
That's a very interesting question, because at the time of the civil wars in Japan, which essentially lasted for about 500 or 600 years.
Which is mind-blowing, but yeah.
It is, yes. Until one clan triumphed. For a long period, I think, if we're talking of samurai, meaning a generic warrior, then anyone could become a samurai.
Okay.
And such was the lawlessness of the times. If you had something to defend, you defended it, so you were a warrior. But as you can imagine, you had the powerful landowners who would tend to attract warriors to them for their cause, who would reward them. And so you have over time the development, very slowly, of something like a professional warrior class. So early on, you have the samurai. Again, I use the word samurai. I just say samurai.
Yeah.
Who were spent some time fighting and a lot of time as farmers.
Oh.
And gradually you have the more specialization into you were either a fighting man or a farmer.
Mm.
And then with the peaceful Tokugawa period, that was written into law.
Oh.
So that you, from about the 17th century onwards, if you were a samurai, theoretically, you did nothing but fight. However, there were no wars. So what you see here is samurai developing. They were becoming the aristocracy.
Yeah.
Whereas everybody else, there were merchants, there were farmers, there were actors, there were priests. Everyone knew their place. And the samurai were the knights who were the rulers underneath the shogun.
Could you describe it as the Japanese version of an European medieval knight?
Yes, I suppose the analogy is, of course, the European feudal system, which lasted a lot longer in Japan than it did in Europe. Yes, samurai were the Japanese knights. It's something that people can understand.
Stories of the samurai are bound with tales of the supernatural, which I know you've talked about. What was this?
Well, the samurai shared with the whole Japanese population this great sense of the closeness of the spirit world, whereby religion pervaded their lives to a very great extent. And you must understand it far more than any formal notion of religion. And there were the influence of Buddhism and Shinto, the native Japanese religion. And so, in that sense, the samurai was a religious person. But you must never think of them as religious wars. It was just something that everyone accepted. And so that's why you have so many legends of samurai worshipping their ancestors who have performed great deeds in the past and who were still present very much so in a spiritual sense.
Hmm.
The other world, what we would term the religious world, was so very close to whatever they did. And far closer than, I say, we would assume in the terms of the medieval knight.
And in this time, there's a couple of terms we might need to know, like a shogun. What was that?
Yes, the shogun, the big cheese. Yes, the title shogun is very ancient, and it refers to the fact that the emperor from very early on was a godlike figure who delegated the responsibility of ruling to others.
Okay.
And the great responsibility of carrying out military campaigns on the emperor's behalf was delegated to a chosen warrior who received the title of shogun, the almost literally the great general.
Oh.
And originally, this was a temporary commission. So you mentioned earlier in the interview about them going off to fight the rebels and the Japanese aborigines in the north. Someone would be given the commission to do it, and he was titled shogun.
Sounds quite Roman, actually.
It is, yes. It is like one of the consuls being sent out and come back to Caesar. And the big change, of course, is what happened in the 12th century when someone who was essentially commissioned as shogun retained the title permanently.
Ooh.
So that the emperor was relegated more and more to being a symbolic religious figure, and the power was passed to the military class. And that was the beginning of a time, really, of samurai dominance and the conflict between various clans over who should be shogun or who could control the shogun. That lies at the back of so many of the civil wars.
But the emperor was still there in the background.
Yes, and virtually worshipped. And imperial commissions were all, and imperial titles that he could grant to samurai lords were regarded as so important, even though if they had wanted to, they could have abolished the emperor. But, of course, nobody did because he was this almost, say, godlike figure. So you have this mixture of almost contempt and respect at the same time. He was venerated and yet had no real political power.
And then we have a word I will struggle with, daimyo.
Well, daimyo, the name, the word literally means great name. And that was the powerful landowners who, during the times of civil war, were the ones who attracted the samurai to their flags to fight in their armies. And so that the greatest daimyo family that emerged in the end, the Tokugawa, who became the shoguns and issued in the 200 years of peace. So
they were under the shogun?
They were under the shogun. But for so many years, the shogunal family resided in the Ashikaga family, and they had 15 shoguns successively over 200 years and were then abolished in 1568 by one of the great warlords who didn't himself become shogun.
Oh.
No, he used one of the Ashikaga family. It was almost like a... The shogun at that time was like a little emperor.
Ah.
Again, theoretically, he had a lot of power. Effectively, he didn't. And then this, say, great warlord, his name was Oda Nobunaga, a great military leader. He may well have become shogun himself had he not been murdered. Well, but almost murdered. He was forced to commit suicide, which...
Ooh,
counts
will.
As murder.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it passed to someone else who could trace his descent to the original shogun. That's how it worked.
Yeah, these forced suicides, were they seppuku or harakiri or something like that?
Well, seppuku and harakiri essentially are the same words, and they refer to the Japanese tradition of ritual suicide, which was performed supposedly by samurai when they were defeated in battle to avoid the disgrace of capture.
You say supposedly?
Well, supposedly, because there are so many instances in Japanese history of, first of all, suicide by other means, of which my favourite one is a man who jumped off a castle tower with a sword in his mouth. there's also one. Actually, that's not the best. Probably the most bizarre case of suicide by a defeated samurai was a man during the 14th century who had himself buried alive on his horse, supposedly.
What?
It might be a legend. But it's so many people know these words, harakiri and so on, and assume that that was how most samurai ended their lives. It's not true. You have many examples of history when an army was defeated and they didn't kill themselves. They were absorbed into the army of the victorious general.
And
he increased his forces that way.
Yeah.
The instances of suicide that you tend to read about are leaders who would willingly let their own troops go, spare them, that they would go to the victorious. But he himself, like we say in English, the captain goes down with the sinking ship.
Yeah.
And so that is why so many cases of suicide seem to be in the upper ranks of a Japanese army, as a way, I suppose, of atoning for the fact that they had lost a battle, they were disgraced.
We tend to see samurais as honorable super soldiers. This honor thing, was this an important part of it?
Yes, the samurai pride, the devotion to the Lord. I think honor is, you've actually used a very good word there, because this seems to be fundamental to the samurai psychology. Again, maybe it wasn't always practiced, because you do have examples of rebellions against one's lord and lords being murdered by their followers, and people even betraying their side and joining the other.
Yeah.
But as in so many concepts of morality in world history, it is perhaps honoured more frequently in the omission than the commission, that you have this ideal that of the samurai who was loyal to the point of death to the lord, unless something else happened.
Yeah, I read somewhere that there was two shoguns or warlords or something that had this yearly event, this yearly battle, and one of them won, and then they just went back home. It's weird.
It's weird. It's also not true.
Oh, it's not.
I know exactly what you're referring to. And it's the fact that there were two rival daimyo called Takeda and Uesugi, and they did actually fight five battles at the same place over a period of about 15 years. And the legend grew that they were like mock battles.
Yeah.
But I have actually written a book about it, these battles of a place called Kawanakajima.
Should have read that.
Available at all good bookstores. And say, it is strange that this legend has grown that they were like mock battles tournaments.
Yeah.
They weren't. I mean, particularly the fourth battle at Kawanakajima in 1561 had one of the highest percentage casualties in the whole of samurai history.
Whoa.
There were two occasions when they developed into a standoff across a river and neither wanted to attack. It was a strategic decision.
Yeah.
I'll go home and try again next year. But there was nothing mock about those battles if you had been inside them.
Today I learned. We also have the name or word Ronin.
Ah, Ronin, that's a splendid word. It literally means a man of the waves. You can imagine someone who's cast adrift at sea.
Yeah.
And it referred specifically to, well, the concept that you brought up earlier of honour, of devotion to one's lord. It was possible that if one's lord was killed in battle and there was nowhere else to go, that the samurai warrior had no one to serve. And there were times when people were desperate for troops. On other occasions, times of peace because the wars weren't literally continued.
Yeah.
And so you would have these Ronin who were basically unemployed warriors. And there are various stories of them causing trouble. There are various stories of them touring the country as super swordsmen, taking on opponents to show how clever they were, all of which have a real basis in fact. But essentially what it is, it's a samurai, a bit like in the films of the Wild West, the lone gunslinger, and of course the basis for so many Japanese movies.
Oh, yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Yes. But the samurai and the Japanese didn't just fight each other. The Korean Peninsula is quite close, and you have China as well. China, under Kublai Khan, he launched an invasion, and he was, I mean, Kublai Khan is almost a by proxy a Mongol invasion. But how did this influence Japan in various times?
Yes, well, it's quite remarkable, say, when you look at Japanese history, that there was so little military involvement with other countries that you're looking at several hundred years of basically civil wars. And certainly you've mentioned the what's always called the Mongol invasions of Japan during the 13th century. Again, you have actually expressed it in the correct way. It was actually an invasion by the Emperor of China, but I think it's perhaps a little politically incorrect to refer to it as a Chinese invasion of Japan. And then again, in the end of the 16th century, you have these remarkable years of Japan invading Korea. And for many years, this was presented as an extension of the great warlord Hideyoshi, who managed to unify Japan effectively as shogun, and then didn't want to stop at Japan. And he really did have a personal aspiration to becoming the Emperor of China. And he invaded Korea, sent Japanese armies into Korea, simply because Korea was on the way to China.
Yeah.
Some elements of the Japanese army did get into Manchuria. But the big surprise that the Japanese armies met, first of all, was that the Koreans weren't willing to let them just pass through Korea, which was Hideyoshi's idea.
Mm.
And then that you had this huge retaliation by Ming China. So the Korean War, 1592-1598, developed into a war between essentially China and Japan, fought on the Korean Peninsula, which was in the end a disaster for Japan, because the combined forces of China and Korea drove the Japanese out. But the interesting thing is, if you look at it, not so much from a Western perspective, which is essentially what I've expressed to you so far, the image of it in East Asia is the first world war of East Asia.
Oh.
Because for the first time, you had Japan, China and Korea fighting. And the influence of it was so extensive in the years afterwards. It weakened Ming China and led to the Manchu invasions. It weakened Korea, from which they never quite recovered. And what a lot of people don't understand is almost the invasion of other countries, because the king of Siam, now Thailand, offered to use the Siamese fleet to attack the Japanese navy. And the Koreans said, thank you very much. But they had actually defeated the Japanese before. Otherwise, you say you'd have had the involvement of Thailand as well. So it's regarded as a far more important episode in East Asian history than we regard it from here. But it still remains, and that this is the amazing thing, the almost unique instance of the Japanese samurai military energies being applied to another country. But there are other little details that in 1609, the Japanese tried to conquer Taiwan and failed. But the one success they had were the chain of islands that lie between Japan and Japan, then the Ryukyu Islands, then Taiwan, then China. And they did manage to conquer the Ryukyu, and that's what's now known as Okinawa. Uh-huh. So that has been part of Japan since then. So that was the Japanese plan. But the interesting thing, this is actually one of my great interests, so I'm going to rabbit on about this.
Yeah, sure.
There were plans, and they were funded, the troops were arranged, and that was for the Japanese invasion of the Philippines. And that was due to take place in the year 1636. And that was essentially Japan seeing the power of the Spanish Empire and how they had taken over the Philippines as a Spanish colony. Uh-huh. And there was a lot of Spanish and Portuguese involvement in Japan, largely through missionaries, not through military work. But what they called the missionary problem, the Christian problem, could be solved by Japan occupying the Philippines. And in fact, the fleet and the army were assembled and ready to go. But what happened was that the army of invasion of the Philippines had been delegated to a daimyo in southern Japan, and he unfortunately suffered a rebellion of his own. And so that the whole idea was abandoned. And then what you got, you had a different Japanese reaction to the threat from Spain. Spain was the real big worry with the Japanese, and that was to cut Japan off from any influence from Europe.
Oh.
And that is the Sakoku Edict, the closed country edict, and popularly regarded as Japan shut itself off from the outside world until 1854, when the American Navy reopened Japan. It's true in part. What it was aimed at was Europe. China and Korea continued to trade with Japan, continued to visit Japan. Japanese went abroad. They went to Southeast Asia. They visited the great temples of Angkor Wat in Cambodia, all through this period. But the big problem was the influence of Portugal, Spain, and the Catholic influence. They saw the missionaries as being, if you like, the stormtroopers of the Spanish army. And so their idea was to cut themselves off. And in fact, it's actually true that Japan had been theoretically isolated, and England, as it was then, wanted to re-establish relations with Japan as part of its expansion of what become the British Empire, the East India Company. And an English ship arrived in Nagasaki Harbour, and great discussions were heard. And the Japanese discovered that the King of England was married to a Portuguese queen. And that was the link. They said no.
Ooh.
So England was cut off as well. And the Japanese managed this exclusion of European influence as a reaction to what they saw rightly as Spanish colonialism in action in the South Pacific.
Huh. Interesting. But since they, well, cut themselves off from European powers and trading, I guess, did they get Western guns, etc.? Or was this through China, Korea?
Well, there's two answers to that. First of all, by the time, still specifically about firearms technology and gunpowder, by the time the Japanese cut themselves off, they already had a well-developed firearms technology of their own.
Oh, okay.
They'd come originally, everyone says, from the Portuguese who had a shipwreck and brought guns with them. That's something of a legend. I personally believe that most of the guns came from Southeast Asia. You can tell this really in the design of the earliest matchlock muskets that arrived in Japan, and they're far more like the Asian design than they are the European, but that's another story. So by the time they cut themselves off, they were already a formidable users of firearms. And the classic example of how good they were was in Korea, where the Japanese firearms were far superior to the Chinese models that tended to be used in Korea. And they proved decisive during the Korean invasion.
Hmm.
And of course, one of the great myths of the samurai is that at the times of peace in the 17th century, that the Japanese abandoned firearms and returned to just using the sword. This is one of the great samurai myths, because the Japanese were formidable with firearms by the 17th century. They didn't give up the gun. What they failed to do was to have the innovations that were coming from Europe. So you do see examples in the 17th century of the wheel lock firearms, and then you have the snap horns firearms. What you don't get are the decisive innovation of flintlocks.
Ah.
So that what you have when Japan opened up to the West in the 1850s, one thing they were desperate to acquire was modern firearms, because even though they had them wonderful by 17th century standards, by 200 years later, they were out of date.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, when the Civil War period started again in the 1850s, is where they got their new firearms from.
Oh.
Because they were basically secondhand from the American Civil War.
Really?
And a lot of the European traders who made a fortune when Japan was opened up, you read of ones who introduced steam trains and stone buildings and wearing top hats. But the ones who made money were the arms dealers.
They always are.
They always are. And as I say, they were basically army surplus from the American Civil War.
The samurai were present in Japan over many, many hundreds of years. We've talked about that. But did the samurai's job description change over this time?
Oh, fundamentally. And in fact, I rather like your use of the term job description, because it's difficult to be a trained fighter when there's no one to fight. And so you have this strange paradox of the samurai with their classic two swords, at which they were supposedly very skilled, and no one to use them on. So essentially, the swords, which represented the samurai, became almost like the badge of office. An analogy I always use is we have this classic image of the English gentleman with his bowler hat and umbrella.
Yeah.
That the samurai sword was the Japanese umbrella, that it was the sign of the aristocratic class. And I remember seeing many years ago, I'm sure it's available, a very good movie called The Twilight Samurai, which deals exactly with this situation, whereby a samurai whose job is sort of administrative civil servant job under the daimyo, keeping books, keeping accounts. He goes to work every day and he's wearing his swords and he puts his sword by his desk. I'm sure you do this here in Oslo.
Yeah, standard. My Viking axe, battle axe.
Viking axe is next to your... Imagine that. And yet the plot of the film is that a samurai who has never wielded a sword in anger in his life is actually required to do so. Some trouble, and he has to go and sort it out. So instead of sitting at his ledgers working out the price of rice for next year, he has to go out and kill somebody. And it really encapsulates the situation for these 200 years of the paradox of a knightly class who were knights in name only.
Yeah. Twilight Samurai?
Twilight Samurai. Yeah. It's very good.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
Was there a time where we can say the mythical peak samurai was?
Do you mean in popular consciousness or in reality?
That's my right. point.
Well, okay, well, I think in popular consciousness, it's the period really between the 12th and the 16th century. That's the ideal time when wars were going on, when samurai could be brave, when samurai could kill people and fired arrows and bullets and attack castles and things like that. The peak time for creating this image of the samurai, I think we are living in it now.
Oh.
Because I'm very, very old. Well, I'm not very, very old, but I was born just after the Second World War. And when I grew to be a teenager and a young man, there was a great reaction against Japan because of memories of the Second World War.
Yeah.
And so the interest in Japan, really since the war, has been developed. First of all, the great popular image produced by Kurosawa's great samurai films, which are absolute classics. And I think in a sense, the samurai image we have derives a lot from that. But what I've seen really in the last 10 years with the growth, not so much of social media, but the capacity of movie making to move away from reality. And one classic example is there's a computer game that's so popular called Ghost of Tsushima. Now, I happen to be something of an expert on this because 2 weeks ago, my 14-year-old grandson gave me a tutorial in Ghost of Tsushima. So I spent a very pleasant evening with him killing Mongol warriors. And I see this almost as an archetype of one example of samurai popular culture that wasn't around 20 years ago, whereby you're having the development of the samurai as a fantasy figure, which in some ways, perhaps he always was. But it's blending now with ideas that come from the Japanese cartoon films, the anime and comic books, manga, all of which I greatly enjoy. And so quite often now, if you read a popular Japanese magazine about a topic on samurai, the illustrations aren't so much of old woodblock prints or suits of armor. They're fantasy figures created using these elements of armor, such as you could see in the historical museum now in Oslo. And imagine those armor, which in themselves are fantastic enough, when you have animal shapes on the helmets and big horns. And then to create them, amalgamate them in this way. So I think my answer to the question is there was the ideal of the samurai is taken from this medieval period, but the peak of its image now is happening as we speak.
That's interesting. And just quickly, we have this different legendary Japanese warrior type called ninjas.
Ninja. Everyone wants ninja to exist. What are ninja? Well, the popular image of the ninja, they are the super samurai. They are superlative at martial arts. and they're invisible warriors in the night. They're almost, if you like, the archetype that gave birth to these fantastic samurai images that we see now. The interesting thing about ninja is if you look at military history of any country in the world, you always have an element of what you might call undercover warfare, special forces, infiltration, night attacks, spying.
Yeah, subterfuge.
And subterfuge. Yeah. You see that in every military society. And it would be amazing if Japan didn't have it.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that there are very, very sound historical examples of that sort of thing happening in medieval Japan. It would be surprising if they didn't. People were assassinated. Castles were burned. And the word they use repeatedly when you translate the accounts is a verb, shinobi, which means to essentially to sneak in somewhere unobtrusively. So the person who did that would be called a shinobi no mono, a person who sneaks in. And that essentially is describing an action. So you have, if you like, a samurai who is good at that sort of thing, or he may not be a samurai. I mean, I think if a daimyo wanted to hire someone to sneak in, he wouldn't choose his great warrior. He would find the local burglar in the village. Over time, you have a merging of a word that's originally a verb, something that you do, which is you sneak in, with a sneaker in. That and people get the idea that this is a special sort of warrior. Now, another way of reading shinobi no mono is to read it the Chinese style, and that is ninja. So that's where the word comes. And, of course, the great thing about Japan is that even though you have examples of this going on all around the world, the Japanese somehow managed to make that into a cult figure. And it's not a modern invention. I mean, I've traced examples going back to the 17th century where they have turned this idea of an infiltrator into a super samurai. And, and in particular, being associated with certain cults based at certain places. And that's the basis of the whole ninja myth. I mean, I could go on of how they started off as spies like anywhere in the world and ended up as comic book heroes. It's a great transformation.
It is. Just about to wrap up, but just for fun, if we compare two different cultures, let's say a fictional medieval battle between some French knights and some Japanese samurais, what would happen? What would the difference be?
Well, I'm glad you said French knights rather than English knights, because yes, it's something I'm quite often asked. If a knight fought a samurai, who would win?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very difficult thing to answer. I think my money would probably be on the samurai. I mean, we have this image, don't we? The popular image has always been that a medieval knight in plate armor was a very clumsy creature, could only move very slowly because of the weight. Now, I think that myth has been disproved, because the way the armor was distributed around the body, you could move quite freely. I mean, there are many examples of nowadays of people who dress up in tournaments and reenactors.
Yeah.
I sometimes wonder what a samurai with his armor would and his sword, what his sword would do against European plate armor. And I don't think anyone's ever tested it. And I don't think anyone would want to, because you'd either have, well, I think it's the case of the irresistible force against the immovable object.
Yeah.
One would break. Though there used to be a strange tradition of testing Japanese swords by cutting helmets in half.
Whoa.
And the technique of helmet breaking. And just this morning, I was at the exhibition at the museum, and you can look quite closely at the helmets and see how they're made of really solid steel plates welded together. And I've seen examples of old helmets that they tested by smacking them, huge force, with a katana. And on some occasions, the helmet has split. And on other occasions, the sword has broken. So I don't think there's a definitive answer. But I'm sure someone one day will want to try. And I hope to be there to witness it.
Professor Stephen Turnbull, thank you for coming to us today.
It's been a pleasure.
And I've certainly learned a lot. And I'm sure we've piqued our listeners' interests on the topic. Do you have anything to plug, any books or something coming out that we should be aware of?
Well, I do have a new book that's just been published.
Oh.
It's called Hojo Samurai Warlords. And the Hojo were one of these daimyo that you mentioned earlier. And it's a topic I've been interested in a while, because during the 16th century, with the introduction of firearms, Japan experienced something of a military revolution comparable to what happened in Europe. And I discovered this particular family, the Hojo, over five generations, over 100 years. They went through all the stages of the military revolution within this one family. The first of the generation, called Hojo Soon, attacked a wooden castle using bows and arrows. His great-great-grandson defended a stone castle using firearms. And so in this one family, you have the whole of samurai history in the early modern period. So
that's interesting.
It's a good one to read.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you for coming here.
You're very welcome.
Og til våre lyttere, bare å sjekke ut Historien endret verden på Instagram og Historisk museum for å se deres samurai-utstilling. Den kan anbefales, har vært der og tatt en titt selv. Og hvis du foretrekker litt mer lokal historie, så det bare å ta en dypdykk ned i Historier som endret Norge. På gjenhør.
Gjenklang.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.